Mouse.
Wrong mouse. I think I'd look good with a Mickey Mouse watch.
I have a Spiro Agnew watch.
Ooh, that'd be interesting.
It's a dated joke, Derek. Back when Spiro Agnew was vice president, he said, Mickey Mouse wears a Spiro Agnew watch.
So it's very untimely?
Yeah.
It's election time.
That's true. It is.
Politics are always relevant.
And or intensely dated very quickly.
Now that we've lost every listener that started watching the clock, welcome to No Driving Gloves, guys. It's Thursday night, 9 o'clock, actually 9:01, because we just had really bad Jane bantered about. And you've got John, Derek, and Dave in the show tonight. Thank you guys for joining us and watching us, hopefully out there on the YouTubes, watching the live stream. Guys, what's been going on? What have you been up to?
Oh, actually, I'm now in my 8th consecutive day off, and I haven't pulled all my hair out, but I haven't done a damn thing. I did score a monthly car wash pass at one of the local car washes, but in the John way, I was able to manipulate him into actually giving me the barcode on a sticker, and they just put it on an index card so I can share it between all my cars. You know, most of those places put that card or sticker up on the windshield. If you ask really nicely, this one place would actually, you know. So now I'm actually considering washing the Fiesta. That would be the first time since I bought it that it would be washed.
You're going to figure out what color it is.
It's black.
Well, now it's black.
It was. Never
washed it. Yeah.
No, that's about all the car related I did. Other than that, I've been 3D printing like crazy and increased the size of my laser today.
That's always important.
I can't claim anything real interesting. My laser is still the same size that it always was. I put new lug nuts on my Corvair since it pointed out to me that I was running not enough shoulder with awfully large holes in my Ford wheels on my Chevrolet. So yeah, I know, right? So I got those switched out, and but haven't actually done the 25 miles worth of driving that I need to before I do the second down, so I don't have caps back. But that's about as cool and car related as it got at the Conwell homestead this week, aside from a little bit of straightening up in the garage and the general work grind stories.
So bigger lasers. So bigger lasers and bigger nuts. All right.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool. This show's off to a great start.
Yeah. So, Derek, you had the most exciting car week, I think, because you were off at Chattanooga, not studying choo-choos, but motor car.
Yes, I was at the Chattanooga Motor Car Festival, which is a really cool event. This was the fifth year of the show, so the fifth annual Chattanooga Motor Car Festival, if you will. And, you know, I'll say this, I think they're still finding their groove. Right. With the show and all the events they do, they did have, you know, in the first few years, they did some racing. They did not bring the racing back this year. So there wasn't that aspect of the Motor Car Festival. But I don't think it hurt at all. There were still great crowds, you know, cars out in the West Village. So West Village is a really awesome kind of redeveloped part of downtown. The Dufour brothers own a lot of that area and just really super place. The Westin is kind of the home base of the show and the event. But yeah, I got down there late Thursday and met my reliable truck that had four of the museum cars in it. Offloaded those. And then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I was in the streets of the West Village of Chattanooga with some of the cars from Lane Motor Museum. So we had the Gregory Sport Roadster there, the Castored Special, the McQuay Norris Streamliner. Dave, you probably know of that car. That's the one that used to be part of the Lane's collection.
Only name I've recognized so far.
Yeah. And I had our bag spots with us. So, just some really cool cars, unique people, you know, obviously coming up wondering what they were because who's ever seen any of those in real life. So, but also great because other museums show up to that show. So you get to see a lot of colleagues, right? I get to see a lot of my friends and colleagues from the field. And so Savoy Illinois Automobile Museum was there, brought five of their cars. And Auburn Core Duesenberg brought two cars down. The Studebaker National Museum brought a car. So we all had a nice little museum gathering. Oh, and I should mention Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum brought down the Ferrari Indy 500 car that they have. So we had a good showing of museums, and you know, the field of cars there was pretty cool too. There were a lot of great cars that showed up. Sport Custom class was fantastic, and there also was, you know, there was a big Luftiger cult gathering. So Porsches, a huge gathering of Porsches there, and Ferraris there were a lot of Ferraris. I didn't count them, but I'd say probably 25 to 30 Ferraris of all vintages there, which was really cool to see. And a nice gathering of Jaguars, and just Jaguar. Some other mixing Jaguar. There was kind of a Radwood section, which was kind of interesting. There were three DeLoreans. There was, and it won an award. I don't remember. I think it was second class. The Plymouth Neon two-door coupe that was competition spec. You guys remember those?
The ACR?
No. Yeah, the competition spec. So, ACR.
There was an ACR and there was a SCCA ACR.
Yeah, I think it was just the ACR. I'd have to go back and look. But this thing was incredible. 20,000 miles from factory. All 20,000 of those miles have been tracked in. And the car is pristine. It was gorgeous. Family car handed down through the family. The father handed it down to his daughter, and the daughter and her husband now track it, and they were all there. And I mean, it was just so cool to see something like that show up at a show like this and get the amount of attention it did. I mean, there were people looking at that car all day long, and that was just really cool. And I think that's the other thing going on really cool in some of these more modern concours, like the Chattanooga Motor Car Festival, is we're starting to see what cars are going to become the next generation of classic cars, right? Who would have expected the Plymouth Neon competition, you know, spec car to be at a Concours d'Elegance, right? I mean, that's just... to me, outstanding that it was there.
They were wonderful cars back in the day. Who would not have expected them to be recognized 25 years into the future, 30 years into the future?
So, Derek, I'm curious, how do you decide what to take to an event like that?
How do I decide?
Well, I mean, who decided to load those particular cars on the trailer for that event? What was the thought process that went?
So, depending on the show, I think it's just number one. Sometimes it's the show that asks for certain cars. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll actually request a specific car. Oftentimes, like Pebble Beach, Amelia Island, some of the bigger concours, you know, they'll ask for either a specific car or a specific, you know, class. Right, we want you to fit this class. But with Chattanooga and some of the other shows that just highlight museums, right, they get their own little area. You know, in this case, Ken Gross, many people know Ken's name, many people know Ken, you know, he is one of the key people in the selection committee for vehicles. So he just reached out to us, and there was one car he wanted to show, be sure was at the show. And that was the Gregory Sport Roadster, because we just recently finished the restoration on it. And it has not been out at a lot of shows yet. It's starting to make its way out. So, you know, that's a really unique, interesting car. Great story behind it. And then really it came down to me as the curator kind of picking out. He said, basically, bring things that people don't normally see. Of course, when you have about 500 cars in the collection that meet that qualification, it gets very difficult to choose. But, you know, I basically sent over like a list of 10 cars that I thought would fit. And then Ken picked four of the cars to come. Yeah, really show dependent. Yeah.
And then you got roped into judging while you were down there, right? Which is the topic of this whole show.
I sure did, Dave. Thanks for bringing that up.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say roped in. I meant to say you enthusiastically volunteered to judge when they proved in need of someone with your expertise.
Well, yes, as Derek said, this is one of the more modern concours, and they're bringing out some of these more modern cars. And I'm sure with Derek's extensive knowledge of brass era vehicles, judges for that category were short and, you know, few and far between. So there was no doubt that they would ask Derek to help judge. That right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I will clarify the story, and I was happy to judge, to volunteer, step up. I've judged at other concours. I'm a regular judge at the Cincinnati Concours at Alt Park. But yeah, when I kind of showed up, and I don't remember, I think it was Friday. It might've been early Saturday, basically found out that a few of the judges were not going to make it to the show. Due to unforeseen circumstances. So basically they came over and said, hey, would you mind stepping in as a judge? I said, sure, I can handle that. And they basically said, we'll hand out assignments, judging assignments Sunday morning in the judges. Okay, great. So go to the judges meeting, you know, sitting around with a few of my friends and colleagues from Museum World and other folks I know. And they finally get me my packet and open it up, and I was honored to judge the Porsche class.
Now, these would have been Porsches from the turn of the century, the electric fairy Porsche car, things like that, right?
The land speed, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, no, there were none of those. They were 1970s, 80s, 90s era, you know, Porsche 911, 930s, you know, cars like that, which, you know, okay. I know a little bit about Porsches. I don't know a ton, but I will say the good thing is that at most of these concours, they ensure that typically the, you know, chief class judge, so the main judge for that class, is an expert in that area if you're judging a marque class. So, you know, fortunately, our chief class judge, he is a Porsche marque judge. So any questions myself, the other judge had, in relation to Porsches, he would answer. So, you know, can I look at a car and judge the restoration quality if it was one that had restored? Certainly can. If I have a question about a certain detail in the restoration, I just had to ask our chief class judge, hey, I noticed this. Is that right? Or, you know, being the young gun of the bunch, let's call it, I always typically get the honor of being the chassis inspection judge. In other words, the guy that lays on the ground and looks under the car. And
because you're the only one that can get up again.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, obviously I had questions. Okay, I'm looking under this. What should a underside of a Porsche, you know, 911 or 930, what should I be looking? Fortunately, being more modern Porsches, most of them were unrestored. So, you know, I could basically judge it on looking at the quality of the condition, you know, cleanliness underneath, and, you know, basically, have they been doing general good maintenance and upkeep of the car based on what I could see under the car. So, you know, am I a Porsche expert? By no means, but also have to remember that in a Concours d'Elegance of this nature, you're not judging the way they would judge in a marque, you know, judging situation at a marque show. In other words, if you were at a Porsche specific show, they're going to be using a point system that they're going to be judging and giving points, or should I say deducting points, based on things they catch. We have a point system we use, but really it comes down to, and Dave, you mentioned this in some of the pre-show chatter we had and text, you know, what most people think of as the French rules of judging, which is the elegance part and the story part. So yeah, you can look at the condition of the car, you can look at the restoration quality, and get, you know, deduct points from every section that you're supposed to look at. But in the end, what it really comes down to is elegance and the story being the car at a Concours d'Elegance. So yeah, that's where you really kind of get into talking to the owners, learning the story, you know, learning more about the car, connections it has to them or their family, and, you know, adding that into the factor of the quality of the vehicle. So now, did one of my colleagues and friends get assigned to the Brass Era class, and he is more of a mid-century car guy? Yeah, that happened. Like, so you want to trade?
if you'd had the 57 Plymouth class, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. How did you know who it was, Dave? Just a good guess.
That's something I've always found interesting about judging. I heard a story from there was a big Hot Wheels show in California this weekend, and the car, and these were, was put on by Hot Wheels, but they were real custom cars. And the car that won best to show received 7 out of 8 votes. And the reason it didn't receive 8 out of 8 is the 8th judge never saw the car, missed it walking through the show. And when they said, well, why didn't you vote for it? She goes, I never saw the car. And they took her over. Oh, yeah, this should have won. So it would have been 8 out of 8. But how can you be a judge and not see every car? It wasn't a huge show. It's not like there's 3,000 cars you've got to go see. It's somebody who probably got her comp tickets, and I know nothing. But you expect some quality and some expertise when it comes to some of these judges. And we're only talking certain shows here. To judge an AACA, it's steps and tiers and studying and things like that. But I've been to Ferrari shows, and I've been to lots of different shows. And sometimes the judges are, no offense, Derek, are people that we need a judge. Oh, hey, would you like to judge? Yeah, what am I judging? Cars. Oh, I'm Amish. Exactly, what's a car? Oh, it's just got 4 wheels. It's like your buggy. You want to judge? I mean, it's a Rolls Royce category. It's got a lot of leather in it. Oh, okay. I'm Amish. I understand that. You would think that sometimes there should be more criteria when people are spending the kind of money they are on restorations or the cars or the value that trophies can bring to these cars on resale and the importance. But so many of these, to me, the judging criteria, the judges are not the experts. They might be big names in the industry. They might be whatever, but more often than not, if you're lucky, they're like Derek experience, where you have a mock specialist and 3 or 4 other people who can critique a few things. And, you know, I've been a judge before. All of us here have judged cars in car shows and for major car events. I actually developed a whole judging criteria for one of the Carlisle shows, which is now changed its focus again. But, you know, I at least knew the topic. You know, I knew my foreign cars, I knew my kit cars, I knew the differences. And then you get some challenges. But what have you guys seen? Is my perspective wrong, or do you think my perspective is more common than, I mean, well, yell at me?
I think your perspective would be the ideal. But I think when it comes to car shows, you get what you pay for, which is we need volunteers and we need them now, and not we're gonna make sure that we fly in the correct experts, that we clear their weekend and feed them and all of the things that you would need. So yeah, I mean, the best of the best, they're gonna do that, but everybody else is pretty much concerned with putting on a show and an experience and making sure that the judging is just not too screwed up so that the wrong people win, or vice versa. You know, politics lays a lot into it. I tell people, honestly, you know, if you want to know how good your car is, take it to an AACA show where the experts are going to tell you line by line what's or not, because I guess they don't share all that with you. So you can't necessarily make the car better according to their feedback. But, you know, a Concours is traditionally just who's got a cool car? It's pretty. And here's a group of respected dignitaries to make that decision. I mean, in honesty, I think that the Carlisle celebrity judging, the best system I've found, which is, yeah, there are people who set up the classes that judge, like, you know, but then they get a gaggle of VIPs that are there for some other reason. And they say, hey, go pick out your favorite car on the field, you know, for whatever reason it is. Talk to the owner. Think it's a cool story. It just jumped out at you, whatever. And we're going to give you a celebrity judge. All in all, when it comes to vehicle gatherings, I think the best awards you can get is that, because it shows you were there, you had a good time, and you really don't care about what your trophy looks like because you got.
I agree with that, Dave. I think you and I, you know, have known each other long enough, and well, started a car club together and held shows.
They ran a show
together. Yeah. That I'm not a trophy seeker, but I do like the dash plaques to show that I've been places. The car has gone out and about and been involved in things and all of that. And, you know, I agree with a lot of what you said. You know, I think one of the biggest problems I have in the judging world, and this is even, let's say, at the AACA level and, you know, all of the concours levels. I'm not going to call out specific places, things like that. But I think we need educated judges that are coming around to the appropriate restoration levels rather than the judges that have so long looked for perfection of over restoration in the field.
Perfection where there never was when it needed to begin with. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Because I have been around a lot of the judges for like Model A's, Model A Ford Club International, places like that. And, or, you know, the Model A Ford Club of America. I don't remember which one because they're so weirdly similar, yet they have to be distinctly different. You know, that they've looked under the you know, chassis, you know, the chassis of the Model A, and somebody doesn't have all of their nuts and cotter pins lined up in the same direction. So they mark them off because, well, if you're restoring it, it should, you know, you should do that. Well, I'm sorry, if we're trying to restore the vehicle and have it be historically accurate, there probably would have been a few of those cotter pins missing because, you know, it was Ford Motor Company and they were putting those T's and A's down the line as quickly as possible. And not everything was perfect when it came out of the Ford Motor Company. The, you know, the, those cars were not 100% everything done to perfection. And to see a Model A that is so pristinely restored, over restored, get, you know, a first in class or anything like, or 100, oh, this is 100 points. Why? It looks nothing like it would have when it came out of the factory. So why should that win any kind of award other than an over restoration or a quality of craftsmanship? Okay, you showed us that you can make it perfect. That's not historically accurate, but here's an award for, you know, your work, you know, great job. But, you know, that's my problem with some of the judging, is the judging that has rewarded inaccurate over restorations that have caused loss of historic information in the antique car world. That's one of my biggest issues.
Well, you know, it's a quandary. And, you know, at least with the Model A restoration hobby, I mean, guys have been restoring those going back to the 50s. And I'm sure at one time when those rules were first created, it was like, how do we split the hairs between all of these otherwise perfect cars? Well, Wayne lined up all his cotter pins and Bruce did not. So we're going to give Wayne the thing. And I it's interesting that you mentioned Model A's, because I've definitely read in some restorer's guidebook for Model A's essentially the argument that we don't care if your car came with something weird and by all appearances it's original. We're here to evaluate what the average was of the Ford Motor Company product. So you're better off to change it to what's expected versus trying to argue with a judge about this is actually on my particular car. And then, of course, you've got the other side, which is like the Bloomington Gold restorations and things, or the McCacken cars, where they're going and they're replicating chalk marks on the firewall and they're replicating overspray and all of the bad things that the factory guys did because they were slapping them together to get the door. And it ends up seeming almost as disingenuous as the fotina you see on some of the hot rod projects, where you're making it look like some perfected version of the imperfect. So I don't know. And it's a problem that really, in order to care about enough to solve, you have to care about getting those awards to begin with, which I generally don't. So I don't have a good solution to that, but it is for sure a real problem. And at the end of the day, the class that I would be most interested in judging would be the class of the unrestored cars.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, I mean, the thing with that, Dave, is that you talk about the chalk marks, you know, the paint marks, all the inspection marks that they did. And it was one thing I learned growing up, and you've met my dad on a couple of occasions, You know, he worked in the GM body shops. He was a body shop manager. He was a, you know, body tech, doing all that work. Of course, now running full-time restorations out of his own shop for almost 30 years now. Oh my God. time flies. And, you know, the one thing I learned from him, because, you know, we had these type of discussions and, you know, we talked about, even when I did, when Dan and I did the GTO, you remember the 74G.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was like, well, do you put the inspection marks on? Do you not? What do we do? How, where do we take this? And, you know, my dad was like, look, he's like, it depended on the guy that was inspecting the car. If, you know, whether it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, how much he'd had to drink, you know, before at lunch and he came back, and if he felt like doing his job or not. You know, I mean, my dad saw these cars when they were brand new, and he's like, let me tell you what, every inspection mark that was supposed to be there was not always there. So how do you know your car had been or not? And number two, the things they would send from the factory, those, the guys would play jokes on the dealerships. My dad had a car that his mechanic friend was working on one day that just wouldn't run right. It would run for a while and it'd stop. And then it'd start up. It didn't, wasn't wanting to get fuel. And so eventually they're like, okay, well, this is the days of carburation, right? So you got to take the carburetor, you know, take the carburetor partially apart and see what's going on. Well, instead of a float in the carburetor, there was an apple core stuck on the float arm. And, you know, it was just some guy felt like it was a joke that he could play on somebody. And my dad found, you know, beer bottles shoved in the chassis, you know, and he had to break them out with pry bars and stuff. So it goes to exactly that. How do you restore a car when you don't know everything about it, right? You don't know that all you can do is restore it to the average, as you said, with the Model A, you know, and I wasn't calling out all Model A judges or all Model A judging. I just know I have seen a few of the guys, talked to a few of the guys, and the impression I got was we're looking for perfection and over restoration, right? We're not looking for a car that's accurately restored. It is one of the things I will say you brought up, like Bloomington Gold, McCacken, some of those different shows. It was one of the things I appreciated about some of the NCRS judging I saw, which is when the chief engineer walks around, specifically in this case, Dave McClellan, was walking around looking at, you know, the C3s, which he was the chief engineer during that period, and he was deducting points because the weather stripping adhesive under the hood was too nicely done. He basically looked at the owner and was like, yeah, we would have had that adhesive gooed all over stuff. He's like, it would never have been this clean. He's like, this is inaccurate. I'm going to have to take it. I was just like, now that's the way to do it. The guy that was there, the guy that knows what it looked like, is telling you it's too clean. Make it messier next time, and I'll give you the full points. I will just say that's one of the things that I like. Now, again, are you ever going to know exactly what it looked like? But if you can know from the chief engineer and the guys that were on the line that, yeah, we weren't that particular, okay, then it doesn't matter if I make it a little messy, and then it looks as it should have. The problem with that is all of the people that come to the show that don't know automotive history, that all they can base their opinion on is modern cars that are done much more to much more perfection by robots. And, you know, there's never, well, usually not any messy adhesive or anything all over the weather. So, you know, that's what makes judging so difficult. Sorry, John, go ahead.
I'm going to say, and that's where you two both said, and I'm in the same boat. I don't chase trophies. I've never chased awards other than maybe when I was 16 or 17 and then trying to impress somebody. But that's where we go back to what I was originally saying. There's value in Dave McClelland deducting points because a Corvette is too perfect, I think is good because it's keeping the hobby in check, and it's maybe devaluing that perfection a little, because they can't go in and say, I scored 1,000 points. Now they say, I scored 998 points. It's not, you know, 1,000-point car because certain things were wrong. And like you pointed out, you know, hey, maybe my Corvette is one that came with a beer bottle stuck in it because it was put together, you know, by a guy that knew he was going to be quitting in 3 hours, and his supervisor had just jumped up his ass, and, you know, things like that. And, you know, Dave here said he likes judging the unrestored, but the problem is we're chasing trophies there too. And some of these unrestored and preservation class cars are now put together with other unrestored, you know, oh, the interior in this unrestored car is better than the interior in my unrestored car, but my body's better than your body, so we're going to take your interior, we're going to put it in my car, and you do it, you know, very carefully and precisely, because these people are chasing egos, and some people's egos are as big as their wallets. And that's why, you know, I think, to me, judging needs to be taken more seriously by everybody but your Saturday night cruising. Because I win a trophy in the Ashley car lot or the Kmart car show of the week, that's probably not going to make my, you know, Honda or my Bentley or my Duesenberg worth a little bit more. Might make me a Duesenberg known because I was at a Kmart in it. But when we're going to larger, more respected shows, you know, and I'm not going to name any, but because I've heard so many, I was just asked to be at this, you know, to judge, and you don't think that. And I always, when everything with me, when it really comes down to it, is the dollar sign, and it affects the dollars. And if I buy a car that, because it won this and this and this and this, and then I get it and go, what? No, this thing's a POS. Do I have a right to go back after these shows to say, hey, this was all wrong and this was all wrong, and I'm relying on your judges to, you know, you're doing the pre-purchase inspection for me. This car came out of restoration in March. It won 16 awards throughout the year. And now I bought it in October, and it turns out this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. You know, I think there's some liability there. And at some point, somebody's going to say there's some liability there. Dave, the lawyer, is going to have a comment here, I heard.
I say, yeah, our legal team's going to jump in.
I think you'd have a real hard time establishing duty from those judges to you, to the car owner, perhaps. Now, if you get recourse against the car owner and you get a court to say, yeah, okay, the car owner held this out as being this level of perfection, and you've established, because remember, you as the plaintiff prove your case, you've established that it wasn't that way, despite the promises. And then maybe they interplead the show and they say, well, your judges said this to me, and they're going to point back at the restorer, who probably is not the car owner at this level, and go, you need to look at them about this, because we're just here for entertainment.
But where I see is, it goes back to an old DUI case that I was just on the outskirts of, fortunately, where it's the, you know, throw it against the wall and sue liability. You know, you sue everybody, and then it's their job to defend their way out of it. Or hopefully, you know, you look for every dollar you can, and then you settle with the biggest dollar.
And you know, it's malpractice not to do that. just but, so we're clear here, like, it's yes. Malpractice not to sue the people who might be liable on behalf of the client to whom you have a duty. This isn't just a money grubbing. Yes. Well, but yes, do go on.
I'm not saying money grubbing lawyer thing. I'm saying money grubbing plaintiff thing. But it's because I ask me after the show and I'll tell you how far they went with their lawsuit. But it could put some of these smaller reputable shows at risk, because they still have to defend it. And if they're doing this for charity and it's a nonprofit, and you know, Pebble Beach or Amelia Island could probably take, you know, the lawsuit and fork over the 10 grand for a lawyer to go, come on, give me a break. You're joking. But your smaller reputable shows, I don't know if, you know, can they even handle affording the call to their lawyer going, hey, I just reserved papers. You know, it's kind of like podcasters.
We call a defendant like that judgment proof, and you don't bother to sue them because you won't get any blood out of that turnip. So defense is in the pre stages. They go, okay, our volunteer judges at our four charity car shows screwed up. Here's every penny you paid us for that evaluation, which is none. So yeah, I wouldn't be too worried about that. That's a very much a defendant's bar propaganda line you're essentially following there, which is we've got to make it harder to sue people because people who don't deserve it are getting sued. But that's not very common the case. And when they are, it's usually pretty easy for them to get out on a minimal basis. And when lawyers who do that with regularity get disciplined. So you've got a balance on both sides.
Yeah, I'm just looking at I always look at the absolute worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, I not only am I a dollars and cents guy, I can be vindictive. And my whole thing might be because I don't want that show to go on. Now,
Hulk Hogan sued that one media outlet out into submission with the backing of that one billionaire because they didn't like the things they said. I mean, anything can happen. And certainly our justice system is not free from abuse if you have the cubic dollars to do it. But that doesn't really reflect on the duty of a car show toward some prospective buyer for their terms of their judging. It's just too tenuous. I mean, you might run it through a trial court and get somewhere, but it's not going to.
Well, we'll just swing it back to cars and we'll then saying even Elon did it just recently with some company.
What, sued him into submission? It's because Elon has the cubic bucks to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's called a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And it's a thing that they've been trying to legislate away in some jurisdictions, but rich people don't like it. The courts exist to protect their property.
Wait, we just went back to Derek's laughing at us, but we just went back to the whole thing here. Ego. Rich people don't like it when you take things away because it hurts their ego. And same thing is it hurts ego when my car loses. So, but it helps my ego when my car wins because the car becomes more important.
So here's the question I have for you guys.
Oh, no, go ahead, Dave.
Well, so we were complaining about restoration, but then I couldn't help but think of America's Most Beautiful Roadster and the Riddler Award. These things where it doesn't come down to what's the best looking or the coolest, but rather which is the closest to literal mechanical and aesthetic perfection with every bolt head aligned and scratch free. And is there a place for that? I mean, ignoring whether it increases or decreases the value of those cars, because I mean, frankly, I think that cars are probably a stupid make money to buy. But, you know, is that something that we think is acceptable that we can at least perfect those cars? And if so, where do we draw the line with ones that are ostensibly stock? But
I just heard an interview with Chip Foose, very, very recent interview. And I didn't realize so much has happened in his life in the last 2 years. And he basically said America's Most Beautiful Roadster is a joke to him. It really doesn't matter. I'm not going to go too far in it because I can't remember exactly and precisely what he said, but it's kind of politics, money, and everybody gets together and okay, this one wins. And it has nothing to do with build quality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he thinks the only show that has legitimate judging left is the Riddler. And wish Will was here to kind of explain the differences in it. But I really wish I could look up probably my YouTube history and see what video I just watched with that. But it was fascinating to listen to Chip basically tear apart the industry that made him wealthy, except he basically said it destroyed in this interview. It said it destroyed him so much he has nothing. He lives in a one-bedroom apartment now and has his tools. He divorced his wife and gave her everything, gave her the businesses, blah, 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 blah. I think he still owns the name Foose Designs and his tools. And it was just kind of fascinating to see somebody that is so well-known and so well-liked actually coming out against an industry that he's questioning if he even wants to stay involved with. I'll see if I can look that up while you guys chat.
I'd be interested to see that.
I want to, number one, because that's fascinating. Number two, I mean, I I kind of got to agree with him. I shouldn't say I agree with him. One of the big problems is this is going to be hard. I did not expect this conversation to go this way, but one of the problems with the shows, all of the events, you know, whether it's the concours, the motor car festivals, the, you know, the Riddler type, you know, the Motoramas, Autorama, those, we have taken a hobby that is supposed to be for fun and for people's passion and interest to be played out. And all we've done is turned it into an industry to monetize it and make people wealthy and have big egos. It's one of the problems I have with some of these, the concours that are out there and some of the events that are out there and certain companies that are out there right now, simply trying to monetize every facet of the hobby because it's taking the passion away from it. No matter what they say they're trying to do, they're removing the passion and the love for these cars and what is supposed to be fun and making it about the almighty dollar and who has the, you know, most perfected restoration and who has the most awards, because that's what's going to drive the dollar up at the auction house that they own.
Very diplomatically put, and yet I think we could all hear the quaking rage in your voice there. And yeah, I mean, and frankly, a lot of this is pretty academic because I'm very happy with $3,500 Corvair that doesn't have any weather stripping, whether it's glued in properly or not. And when I do work on it, I'll do the best I can, regardless of what the factory did. And I probably won't do as well anyway. So, you know, that to me is the real appealing way. And that's the dash plaque end of the car show hobby. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting while you were talking, I was thinking about how much marketing a thing that strokes your ego, whether it's clothes or brand name, alcohol or whatever, requires marketing that makes you dissatisfied with the status quo. So like the way your car is not perfect. It needs to be more perfect to pay us to make it more perfect. And so it does naturally lead to that kind of angels dancing on the head of a pin level of making everything glossy and neat down to the other. It's a Riddler contender or an over-restored Concours car. And you know, it's a big tent. And generally, I suppose things that make people happy don't upset me unless they hurt somebody else. And in this case, the risk is, and I think this is probably your real passionate point about it, is it risks destroying history. So if the Bugatti that won Pebble this year gets restored to that perfection level, no matter how correct it may be, they've still erased whatever there that had survived from the old days. Now, on the flip side, a lot of cars have already been screwed up by years of damage or an improper restoration back when they weren't worth much, et cetera. So there's probably still room for absolutely everything. But yeah, I mean, the judging certainly at some of those events could be tailored in a way that hopefully disincentivizes the over-restoration of those things. And John has disappeared entirely. He's not even visible anymore.
I had to go there to the keyboard.
He's just completely just gone on the conversation.
He's just gone. No.
And I agree with that, Dave. And it's one of the things that I try to point out is, you know, there are, and as you said, there's different levels here and there's different ways we have to look at every vehicle that's out there, right? Because, you know, your mass produced, you know, Model T or Corvair or a Falcon. Okay. Dave owns a Corvair. I own a Falcon. Dave's owned Falcons before. You know, we have to understand that, and this is one thing I try to do as a curator, is to make the museum visitor understand that, yes, there are cars on exhibit that have dents, that have scratches, that have paint that's not perfect, because we have to remember that the most significant part of the story of the automobile, whether it is a Model T, a Duesenberg, a Bugatti Royale, a Ford Falcon, a Maybach sedan, whatever car you're looking at. Its purpose was to be a machine that was used by mankind to get from one place to another. It changed the way people travel. It changed society and culture. And when you use a machine, it gets damaged and it gets wear and tear. And all of that damage and wear and tear is part of the story of the automobile. And that is why you see cars in museums that are not perfect, because their life was lived as a machine that took people sometimes from one city to another, one state to another, one country to another, and they suffered damage on those trips. And erasing that erases all of what the automobile stood for, stands for, and has done for history. So it's a big part of one thing that I will always fight for from the historian aspect and the curatorial aspect and the historic vehicle conservator aspect, is that we don't make every historic automobile 100% perfect, because then we have erased history.
And it's interesting, because I can't help but sit here and think that if you were to have cloned some great person in history, Mahatma Gandhi or Abraham Lincoln or whomever, you'd still just have the vessel, right? You don't have the soul and the story once that body is back. So it's the same thing. I mean, I think, don't the Japanese call that wabi-sabi, visual evidence of an object's story that it sort of wears on its surface. And, you know, when things get broken, they repair them in a way that hopefully is both beautiful, but also does not disguise the fact that it has incurred some level of damage and then been taken back to functional. I think, to me, that's the ideal historical object, regardless of whether it's a car or a tool or a piece of clothing or what have you. I really like to see all of that history accumulated without it being outright decay, but just the lived-in look, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the approach of objects conservation, right? We, you know, number one, do no harm, right? If it's a treatment that is going to damage or harm the object worse, don't do it. But it's never going to look perfect, right? We're going to stabilize it in the condition it's in. We're going to halt further decay and further degradation, but we're not trying to restore it. We're trying to conserve it. We're trying to stabilize it, preserve it for as long as we possibly can in the condition it's in, because that's its story. Yeah, we remove corrosion. We stabilize the corrosion. Structural damages we will fix. Sometimes, yeah, we either blend it in, or sometimes you try to make it stand out so people know what has been done. As you mentioned, Dave, you know, the Japanese art. I don't recall the name. Wabi Sabi might be the right name.
It's like that, or kintsugi or something. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, that's where you'll see them use, you know, basically they have a process where like broken ceramics will be repaired with gold, you know, adhesives that they, you know, that they use that are actually have gold in them. And then you see all of the cracks, but they're just gold now. They're no longer the same color as the pottery, but rather they are gold cracks that are holding, you know, that have now been bonded and hold the object together. It's absolutely beautiful. You know, and a number of the vehicles and objects I've done conservation on, you know, the point is to make them look exactly the same as when you started, just stable, just that they're not still flaking paint and they're not, you know, corroding further and degrading any more than they had been. Everything's been halted. But if someone had seen it before and walks in 2 days later and you're done with the treatment, they're not going to go, oh, that looks different. I mean, it might be a little cleaner, but you know, it's not eye-catching that, oh, they did major work to, unless it's absolutely necessary. However, I will say, going back to the judging and automobiles and everything of that nature, in the preserved class, if you have a barn, it's okay to dust. The dust does not stay on, especially when you're pushing it around, leaving handprints in the dust, because you're removing that dust. So just remove all of it and make sure the paint is stabilized, because that's actual properly cleaning and stabilizing the surfaces. Just pulling it out of a barn, getting it running, and doing nothing else. I mean, if you don't know how to do the rest of it, okay, don't do it, but find somebody that's trained, myself. There's a number of other conservators that I know that I can recommend that can properly, carefully clean that and stabilize the paint surfaces for you so that we can actually preserve that car for history.
You know, I before I got into old cars as a profession, I was headed toward historic preservation of buildings. And it's an interesting debate there about how much changes should show versus try to be integrated in buildings' original fabric. And of course, there also you have the mantra of the least invasive means of repairing, restoring, etc. But it's interesting because the question is then, if I have this old brick building and it needs for its functional reuse some sort of reconfiguration of its footprint, an addition, do I try to make a sympathetic here that looks like it was part of the original building from 1929 or whatever? Or do I make something that is obviously from 2024 so that people know this is the original fabric of the building and this is the modern addition? I think aesthetically, I prefer the former, but philosophically, I almost...
Now see, when I did preservation work 15, 20 years ago, whatever, that the latter is kind of what they lean to you preserve what's there, but anything that needs to be repaired, replaced, you make it kind of obvious that it's from a different time period. There's a example of a castle somewhere, obviously in Europe, where people hate it, absolutely hate it, because it's this absolutely gorgeous castle, and it, you know, they did the preservation to the structure that was there, and then they built this cubism modern thing on the top two-thirds of it at an angle. And it makes it the ugliest building on the face of the planet. But the way preservation society and preservation thought, that's the way it should be. Let's have the original castle, and then let's be obvious of the updates that are done. I personally always had a struggle with that coming from automotive restoration, because my job in automotive restoration is to restore a car, and by any means possible, I'm supposed to make it look like it did at some certain time period, whether it be when it's new or whether when it finished such and such a race, or, you know, when Jimmy Durante owned it. It doesn't really matter. It has to look like you pick a photograph and you make it look like that. Mm-hmm. If it happened to get dented, you take the dent out. Unless it was dented at that point in time that you're trying to replicate. But then when it came to preserving the Titanic artifacts or the Saturn V, which kind of even crossed lines there a little bit, but buildings and structures and statues, you hid the repair, but you made it obvious that it was a modern repair and it wasn't part of the original structure.
You know, and it's, they have a similar problem with the national parks too, which is to say they were all created in, you know, the 1890s through the 1910s, and they wanted to arrest them exactly as they were. Like, this is conservation, right? Except that they were never in that level of stasis. And so they found themselves constantly having to make these corrections to try to essentially arrest these landscapes in time when they were never static that way. And I imagine that's something of an issue when you're doing preservation work as well, because the entropy doesn't really stop. You've just slowed down the clock a bit for some time.
Well, yeah, especially and especially in the automotive world or any mechanical object, right, that we're still going to operate. Every time we operate it, we add wear and tear because, you know, friction, right, within an engine. We have metal surfaces rubbing on each other. Granted, they have oil, hopefully, between them. And, you know, but you're still causing wear. So we have to balance that when we have operational artifacts. You know, we have to balance that with the preservation of the object and make sure that we pay attention to the condition of the engine, especially if it is an original engine that is significant and you start finding issues with it that could lead to its untimely destruction. You want to take that into consideration on how often you make that an operational vehicle.
What just crossed my mind as you were saying that, Derek, is if we take what I just described from the preservation architectural world and we put it in the automotive restoration world, don't we have a resto mod?
That made me think that as well. When you said it, it was like, well, the original flathead's worn out, so we put it in LS so nobody would think that this was the original flathead anymore. Or it was gone yes, entirely, right? Well,
I mean, you have a point. You have a point.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, actually, think about the electrifications of classics that we've got going on now. They almost lean into that. I mean, they tend to be more in the vein of modification of existing cars and not restorations of complete cars, or not restorations, rehabilitations of incomplete. But they would seem to sort of fall into that same vein as the glass enhanced castling.
I don't know about that, because the addition space on a building does not impact the original, basically, let's call it the original use or facilities of the original structure. Okay, so that castle could look exactly like it did in the 14th century. Everything could operate the same way it did in the 14th century, and the modern addition could operate as though it's 2024. If you electrify a historic vehicle, it no part of it can operate the way that it did at the time it was created. You have changed the overall existence of that vehicle.
Well, see, I don't know that I agree with you there, because I think for one thing, in John's example, we didn't take a complete functional preserved but decrepit 14th century castle and build an addition onto it. We took ruins and we turned them back into a functional building by installing obviously modern parts on them. So take, for example,
an old MGB with a seized engine.
Right. So we've got this MGB with a seized engine, or the engine's gone entirely. This is not going to run again as its original form. Unless we find another MGB engine and put it in, which is no longer the original MGB. It's two cars Frankenstein together, like our purported barn finder here that's got the need for another. But if I do electrify this MGB, and yet I leave all the switch gear and the window cranks and everything intact and functional in their original respect, I do have this marriage then of this patinaed yet stabilized 1960s artifact that's been obviously merged with this 21st century technology while preserving the original elements. So I'm not advocating this. And certainly, you know, in the case where you've just simply gutted a shell and built a street rod, that's a totally good thing. But when you do have this mixture of potentially preservation and modification, I think that would be philosophically the same, the resto-modded castle.
No, like I said, it's really with all the industries and the way I was educated in restoration. Derek's a little bit different because Derek was educated in preservation and came into restoration. It's really tough for, I think, either one of our heads to totally grasp the other. I mean, a lot of Derek's theories are very solid in the automotive world, but a lot of Derek's theories are really tied to originality and function and are functioning original, is I guess a better way to say that, where mine was to make it appear original, or like I said, to a certain date. Derek wants to go back to day one. I want to go to kind of day one, but I don't care how much new stuff goes on there. I always had the kind of take your MG example there, is we had a Jaguar XK, can't remember, it was a 120 or 140 coming to the shop. And when we're drivetrain's perfect in the car, runs and whatever. But when we went to take the body off, it broke into three pieces because it was so corroded. In Europe, they would have just bought a new body and popped it on the car. And that's not the way restoration's looked at in the United States. Instead of buying a $30,000 body and popping it on the car, it went over to metal shop. And $160,000 later comes out as the original body with 90% new sheet metal in it. it, you know, there's just so much in this industry that doesn't make sense. And as we've explored through this journey from Derek, you know, seeing a couple of cool cars in Tennessee last week to being drafted as a judge to where we are now, there's a lot of theories and, you know, legalities, and it's just a huge, huge topic. And we, if you really wanted to get bored, we could probably develop a multi-episode podcast on this.
I feel like the way this is going, we may need to, because I like where this is going and I like conversations, and we need to get this out there. And maybe even get input from some other people.
Well, we can really explore doing that. Won't be able to jump into next week because Derek's going on vacation. He thinks because he's done the podcast for 7 years, he thinks he can take 3 weeks in a row off. And I know many of our listeners will be very disappointed to lose Derek for 3 weeks. But we have Dave to have stimulating conversation with me, which I think at that point, Dave's probably the highlight of the show. Or we might have a couple. I am working on trying to get a couple of interviews put together, some special episodes in the next 3 weeks. And when we return, surprise, guys, I mentioned it to you a few weeks ago, we're going to do our holiday wish list. So be getting your Christmas list together over the next 3 weeks. So Derek will be gone until what, mid-November, right before Thanksgiving, probably. And we'll... our Thanksgiving episode might be pre-recorded and it'll be our Christmas wish list. We'll have all those details worked out, but I'm wrapping this up obviously because we're pretty good into this hour-long show. I did for the last 15 minutes have the name of that YouTube video. It was Road to Success podcast on YouTube, or actually as an audio podcast with Ben Fowler. Chip Foose, ex-Overhauling Star, breaks silence, the truth about Boyd Coddington and car design. I put the link in our chat, and Mike Wilkerson, acquaintance of mine, actually put the link in the chat and texted it to me. So we've got the links in the Facebook chat. I don't think it'll show up on the YouTube chat, but if you watch this on YouTube, everything you need to find it is there. And it is a good, it's for 39 minutes, but it's a really good interview. And like I said, I didn't realize Chip was at that point that he is, and he looks great. I mean, towards the end of Overhauling, he looked like death. I mean, my skeleton on the front door looked better than him, but that's all I'm going to say for tonight, unless I say a goodbye after you guys get done with your closings.
Well, all I've got to say is.
All right. And guys, for John, Dave, myself, we thank you for watching, listening to us, whichever way you hear this podcast. We are glad that you are part of the No Driving Glove community. And remember, if you want to help us out, if you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, any of those socials, we got the QR codes up to buy us a coffee. 10, 15, 20, 100, whatever you want to buy us. It helps us get the show out and get these stimulating conversations out to the automotive world. And hopefully one day somebody will listen to us. But beyond that, you guys, we appreciate you being here, listening to us. And remember, if you want to help the No Driving Gloves community grow, one thing I always like to say that you guys probably already know very well, if you want to help us grow, share the show.
Thanks, Mike, for the compliment. Good night.